Okay, so y'all ready to get started? So here we are in chapter 1, right? And everyone's read chapter 1 by now. So the first question here in chapter 1 is, what is the economic problem? And the economic problem is that because we live in a world of scarce resources, but people have unlimited wants and needs, how do we meet their needs in this world of scarcity? So it's going to take me a little bit here just to explain some of the vocabulary in this definition and what this definition means. But let me just warn you that economics is very much like a foreign language. In fact, you can buy dictionaries just on economic terms. So terminology is very important, and one of the purposes of the first four chapters is just to introduce you to certain vocabulary and certain concepts. All right? So so just keep that in mind, and that's what we're doing here. We're just making a definition here, and I'm giving you an overview. Make sure you sign the attendance form.
I was going to sign that afternoon.
Yeah. The economic problem is one of those definitions. So, see, what is economics all about? Well, no matter how far you go in economics, you can get a PhD in economics, and yet you're still faced with the same economic problem. And that problem is that we live in a world of scarce resources. Now, in our assumption of evaluating the economy, we assume that people are going to behave in accordance to their own self-interest. All right? Now, when we look at the economic problem, we're going to assume that people work in accordance to their own their own self-interest. So does that sound like a selfish system? I mean, you know, if everyone's, you know, thinking of themselves and everyone's doing what's, you know, just what's best for them, then, you know, that kind of sounds like it's a me type, you know, what's in it for me type system. But yet the opposite is true. Because of a certain natural law, and that law is that whatever it is that you give away, that's what you keep. And whatever it is you keep, you lose. Now, those of you here last semester, you might understand that. But does that sound like a riddle to you?
Yes.
Sounds like a riddle, right? Whatever it is you give away, you keep. And whatever it is you keep, you lose. Now, what two things do you all want because you're here? I mean, it's proof to me that because you're here, you want certain things out of life. Now, what are the two basic things you want in life, and that's why you're here?
Money.
Money and?
Education.
But what's an education going to allow you to do?
Anything.
Now, what's a job going to allow you to do?
Money.
Time and money, right? Time and money. You want, because you're in college and you expect to get a college degree, you expect in the future to have more time. Now, when we say time, we mean more flexible time. To do what you want to do, when you want to do it, and whom you want to do it with. Does that sound like a good idea?
Yep.
And you want the money to afford it, correct?
Yep.
I mean, that's the best of both worlds, right? If you had all the money to do what you want to do, and you had the time to do it, you've just about arrived, correct? Now, what two things are you giving away by being here? Time and money. Right? You're giving away, you're saying, well, now, I've got this money, and I could take this money, and I could whatever with it, but I'm gonna give my money away to New River Community College. Right? And by giving your money away, you expect to have more money in the future. And what is time? Well, time is, where would you rather be right now than here? Yeah, a lot. Well, whatever it is, bad or on a cold, rainy day like today, it's maybe home by the fire. I don't know, but you know, I'm assuming that you know, most of you would probably be somewhere else. I mean, I know there's a few of you that are here because you've heard that, that you know my lectures are so exciting, and you know you'd rather be here. You know, so I like to believe that, right? But the point is that you're giving away your time, right? You say, well, I'd rather be, you know, somewhere else. I'd rather be in Starbucks, you know, drinking coffee and whatever. But I'm going to give my time away. Because why? Well, because you expect to have more time in the future. Now, think of these, some friends maybe that had not made this decision that you've made. Think of some friends that said, you know, I don't want to give my money away. I just want to get a job, and I want to get paid for what I do. See, I'm not going to give my money away, and I'm not going to give my time away. See, when you've got a job, you're not giving your time away. You're getting paid for your time, right? So you're not giving it away. Yeah, you're selling your time, exactly. In fact, that's what a job is. You're essentially selling your labor. Now, statistically speaking, I mean, this may not be true 100% of the time, but it's true in your heart. It's true in your heart. I mean, if you thought that you could make more money and have more time by not going to school, would you be here? No, probably not. But see, your friends that said, no, you know, I'm not going to go to New River. I'm not going to give my money away. I'm not going to give my time away. Statistically speaking, I mean, if you look at how much money college grads make over their lifetime and how much money you know, high school grads make over their lifetime, what do you find? You find that the college grad makes a whole lot of more money than the person that never went to college, right? And you also find that if you've got a college degree, that you've got professional job. A professional job gives you more flexible time. I mean, most professional jobs, you're not going in at 8 o'clock and punching the clock and leaving at 5 and you know, punching the clock, you know, as you leave and getting credit, you know, for every minute you're there. I mean, professional jobs don't work that way, right? Yeah, they're salary based. And generally speaking, there's a lot more perks involved. There's a lot more. You've got more choices, right? With a college degree and a career, you've got more choices. See, and that's what I'm talking about. So for those people who did not give away time and did not give away money, and they tried to keep their money, they tried to keep their time to do what they want to do right now, what happened? They lost what? In the future, they lost time and money. See, whatever it is you keep, you lose. You try to keep your time, you try to keep your money, over your lifetime, you lose time, you lose money. But if you give away your time, and you give away your money, then in the future, you get more time and more money. Does that make sense?
Now it does.
And that really illustrates something else. What it illustrates is a lot of what you're going to learn in this course, you already know. Now you might say, well, why take this course if I already know it? Well, the reason is you don't know you know it. And one of my jobs is to reach into your subconscious and reveal to you those things that you already know, but you're not aware that you know it. Like what I just went through is just an example. You knew, because that's why you made the choice of coming to school, that of this, what it sounds like a riddle, whatever it is you keep, you lose, and whatever you lose, you keep. I mean, you knew that, but you couldn't explain why you did what you did, right? And that's a lot about what economics is. Because really, economics is just it's a study of life. It's a study of how does the world really work? I mean, what is truth? What is truth? See, in this economics course, we're truth seekers. Because if you know the truth and you act on the truth, then there are great rewards. So, well, there's lots of examples of that today. So, anyway, what is the? Let me get back to this rationale of this self. What is the rationale of self-interest? See, people select alternatives they expect will yield the most satisfaction and happiness. So what is macroeconomics? Macroeconomics is the study of the economy in the large. In macroeconomics, it's like we're flying over the economy in an airplane, and we're seeing how everything fits together. So we look at things like inflation, unemployment, interest rates, money, banking, things like that. So what is microeconomics? Microeconomics is the study of the economic behavior in particular markets, such as the market for computers. Microeconomics involves the decision-making process of economics. Decisions. If we have one semester of macro, one semester of micro. When you transfer to a four-year school and you want to declare a major, most majors require a semester of macro and a semester of micro. And so there are two different ways of looking at the economy. Macro means large, micro means small. How does a business owner make decisions of what price to charge to maximize the profit? That's what we're going to do. I mean, I can't answer that because that's what this course is all about. See, it's decision making. There are certain tools. See, you're going to be given certain tools that you're going to be able to use to reason through to the correct answer. See, what I mentioned last time in our introduction to this course is that econ is more like mathematics than it is history. Okay? More like mathematics than it is history. That's why the online test can be open book, open note, because many of the answers are not even in the book. Many of the answers aren't even in the lectures. See, what's in the book and what's in the lectures? The principles. Okay? The principles. It's a way of thinking. So, microeconomics involves a decision-making process. What thought process do you go through to decide how to maximize your welfare? I mean, what are you going to spend your money on? Well, sometimes necessities and sometimes not, but you're constantly making decisions, right? You've got so much money and you are in time and you can either do this or do that. So what kind of thought process do you go through each and every time to make a decision to do this or do that? Well, that's what microeconomics is all about. That was really my point. So now, what is a good? A good is a tangible item that is used to satisfy wants. More vocabulary. Something tangible that you might buy or use is called a good. And what is a service? A service is an intangible activity that is used to satisfy wants. So you spend your money on goods and services. Goods is something tangible. A service is like getting a haircut or paying someone to do your taxes. Now, what is a free good or service? A free good or service is when there's not enough of a good or service to go around for everyone who wants it for free. Like you can get water from a drinking fountain and not pay money for it. You can drink as much as you want. See, it's free. I mean, in this setting, there's a drinking fountain here in this building, and you can go and, without paying anybody for it, you can drink as much money as you want. You can drink as much water as you want. So we call that a free good. Now, it's a free good because there's plenty to go around for everyone who wants it for free. Now, compare that with a scarce good or service. What is a scarce good? Here's an example of what I mean by vocabulary. If I ask you right now to explain to me what the word scarce means, most of you would say something like, well, scarce means it's rare or it's hard to come by. But that's not what it means in economics. See, in economics, there are definite definitions of things. And it's very important that you understand the definitions. Now, scarce in economics simply means that there is not enough of a good or service to go around to everyone who wants it for free. That's what scarce means. There's not enough for everyone who wants it for free. Now, if that be the case, how do we decide who gets and who doesn't get? Yeah, now there are many ways really to decide, but in terms of our economy, and that's really what we're studying here, right? We're studying the American free enterprise system, right? I mean, in a free market system, we decide who gets and who doesn't get when there's a scarcity by the price mechanism. Now, if there's not enough for something to go around for everyone wants it for free, the market puts a price on it. When the market puts a price on it, who gets? Number one, people can afford it, and number two, people who want it. It takes both, right? It takes a want to, and it takes money. So those who can afford it, and those who want, get, and those who can't afford it, or those who don't want, don't get. So since there's not enough for everyone at a zero price, we say, well, here is a peaceful way to decide who's going to get and who's not going to get. All right? Now, when is a good or service scarce? When the amount people desire exceeds the amount available to them at a zero price. That's another way of looking at what scarce means. Now, see, keep in mind here that what I'm really doing is that I'm explaining to you the economic problem. The economic problem is that we live in a world of scarce. Now, what have I just done? I've just explained to you what scarce means, right? Okay, we live in a world of scarce, what? Resources. So we have to know what the word resource means. Resource is something that is used to produce goods and services. Something that is used to produce goods and services. That's a resource. So what are resources? Land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurship. Four types of resources. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to explain what each is. Okay, so first of all, definitions, right? First four chapters is heavy on just definitions. So what is land? Land is plots of ground and other natural resources used to produce goods and services. What are some examples of land? Well, land might be, could be anything from the earth. Fresh water, it could be dirt. Iron ore, silver, timber, gold, silver. Anything that we can extract from the earth that we can use in our attempts to solve the economic problem is what is called a land resource. Okay? Now notice here that if we're talking about a resource, it's got to be something natural from the land that we are going to use in our attempts to solve the economic problem, in our attempts to produce goods and services. See, first of all, can we ever solve the economic problem?
No.
See, if we were to solve the economic problem, that would mean that everyone would be able to have everything they want. So we'll never solve the economic problem. But can we come closer and closer to solving the economic problem?
Yes.
Yeah, see, it's really, that's why economics is, in higher levels of economics, is tied very close to calculus. You know, calculus is a study of limits. You know, it's a study of, well, you will never get to a certain point, but we can get closer to that point. And that's what economics is all about. We'll never solve the economic problem, but in our attempts to solve it, we can get closer and closer. So that's what a land resource is. Well, what is labor? Labor is the physical and mental efforts of humans used to produce goods and services. Now, again, keep in mind, we're talking about solving or trying to solve the economic problem. And this brings up another point, a related point, and that is this. In economics, we are only concerned with the market. If it's not happening in a market, then we're not concerned about it. Now, a market is a place that buyers and sellers meet. It's a market. If you want to sell something like a food, for example, groceries. We talk about supermarkets. You know, a supermarket is a place where you can buy food there, and people who sell food, they know that's a place they can go to sell food. The stock market is a place that people sell stock from, and where people can go to buy stock. See, markets. Markets is where buyers and sellers can come together. All right? Now, if there's not a market transaction here, then we're not concerned about it. If you go to your neighbor and cut your neighbor's grass, and your neighbor pays you, that's labor. If you cut your own grass, that's not labor. Now, what's the difference?
You're not getting paid.
Yeah. See, when you go cut your neighbor's grass and he pays you, there's a market transaction here. But if you cut your own grass, there's no market transaction. So we're not interested about you cutting your own grass. We don't count that as labor. All right? So labor can be physical or mental. It can be skilled or unskilled, but it's some effort in our attempts to produce goods and services. And we produce goods and services in our attempts to solve the economic problem. Now it's just vocabulary, okay? Land, labor, and capital. What is capital? Capital are the machines and tools used in the productive process. A hammer in the hands of a professional carpenter is an example of capital. You know, a carpenter goes to work, uses a hammer, builds a house, he sells that house. That hammer was a tool that was used in our attempts to solve the economic problem, to produce goods and services. Is the hammer that you have at home capital?
No.
What's the difference?
You're not getting paid
for it. Yeah, because you're not using that hammer in a market transaction. See, like I drive a pickup truck every day, and boy, I tell you, if you want to be popular, just get a pickup truck. You know, all kinds of people want to borrow your truck all the time, and So it does come in handy, and I do a lot of things with it, you know, furniture and wood and mulch and just all kinds of, you know, miscellaneous things. But is that truck an example of capital?
No.
No. Why? Because I, you know, I don't have a business, and I don't use my truck to you know, in my, you know, in my engagement in into the you know, producing goods and services. Yeah, yeah. If that truck is used in our attempts to solve the economic problem, then it's capital. A truck with a, you know, that a contractor would own is capital. So in other words, really the point I'm making here is that it's not just the physical thing that determines what it is, but rather it's how that thing is used. And in this case, if it's used in a market transaction, then we count it, it's considered. But if it's not used in a market transaction, then we don't consider it. You know, it's like, let's suppose that we came up with a fertility drug that doubled the birth rate of cows. Question.
Capital.
Would the supply of cows increase?
Yes.
Yeah, it depends. It depends. Maybe yes and maybe no. Now, when would the supply of cows increase? Yes, if those more cows were brought to market, then the supply of cows would increase. But even though we've got twice as many cattle standing in 4 feet, if it just so happened that we didn't take those extra cows to market, then the supply of cows would not increase. How come? Because if they're not a market transaction, we're not concerned about it. In economics, we're not concerned about it. We're not concerned about how many cattle are in 4 feet. That is irrelevant information. It's useless information. The only useful information to us is how many cattle are being brought to market. All right? See, economics is the study of markets. Okay? So capital here is a machine or a tool. You know, a computer might be an example of capital. But the computer, I suppose the computer I use in terms of what I do in terms of education would be an example of capital. But a computer that you might use at home for, you know, your personal use would not be capital. See, there's also something called human capital. What is human capital? Well, human capital is the acquiring of skills and knowledge in order to function with capital. In other words, would a computer be of any use if no one knew how to run the programs on a computer? In other words, a computer is only good if you've got programs to run on it, right? I mean, the internet, Word, PowerPoint, I mean, Excel, I mean, you've got to, you know, there are different programs, right? Now, how useful would a computer be if it was produced and it's functioning great and it got all these programs on it, but no one knows how to even turn the thing on? Well, the computer wouldn't be very useful, would it? So what do we need in order to take full advantage of our capital? Well, we need to invest in education. And that's what we do here at New River. At New River Community College, you acquire, you know, human capital. You learn, New River's got one of the best programs in the IT field, technology. I mean, we've got, you know, a better program in many aspects than even Tapper Radford. I mean, we've got state-of-the-art teachers and equipment and programs that we offer. And you're very fortunate to go to a school that has invested so heavily in the technology area. And if I were you, really, while you're here, I'd take full advantage of that, because believe me, it's not like this, you know, many other colleges. But that's just an example of human capital. Okay, you know, you learn to, you know, work with the computer, and you learn, you know, to work Excel and PowerPoint and all these other programs, and then you see, then you can work with the computer, and the computer becomes more valuable. Okay, so there's capital, and then there's human capital. Okay. By the way, you know, what is it that, just as a side note, what is our main, what is the main thing that we sell at New River?
Education.
Well, it's really not education.
Hope.
Hope. We are in the hope business. See, why are you here? See, is there any guarantee that you being here at New River and getting a degree, and even if you were to transfer to four-year school and get, you know, a four-year degree, I mean, is there any guarantee that any of that's going to benefit you? There are no guarantees. So why are you here? Because you have hope in your heart, right? You believe in your heart that by acquiring this knowledge and these skills, because again, you know, we're talking about human capital here, that you're going to be better off in the future. See, we can have the best teachers at this school, the best programs, the best computers, the most up-to-date programs. But if you all didn't have hope in your heart, these halls would be empty. Right? So we are in the hope business. That's why one of the reasons why the worst economy gets, the higher our enrollment is. As what we're experiencing right now. I mean, you all know that the economy is not in too good a shape, right? You all know that things are getting worse. Reading the papers where Volvo's laying off, 600 some workers? And, huh? And Corning, that's another thing too. Corning is just a stone's throw from here. And the headquarters, I think, just announced that they're going to lay off 13% of their workforce. Of course, every day we read in the newspapers that, you know, one business or another is laying off people. Look at Circuit City. I mean, they're out of business. They just went bankrupt. So what's happened to our enrollment here at New River? Well, at this point, we have a record enrollment. I've got more students now than ever before. My enrollment is, I've got 350 students so far. And I could easily have 400 students out that by the end of the semester. And I've never had, you know, that many before. So what am I saying? Well, I mean, the reason for that is why? Because people come because they have hope in their heart. That, well, okay, things are bad now, but if I do this, you know, in the future, things will be better. Okay, so what is entrepreneurship? Now, what we're doing here is that we're talking about resources. See, what is the economic problem? We live in a world of scarce resources. What are the resources? Land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurship. Now, we've already talked about land, labor, and capital. So what is entrepreneurship? Entrepreneurship, one, it's a not an easy definition, but one definition that your book gives is that it's a managerial and organizational skills combined with the willingness to take risks. And that's a very short definition. So I'm going to take a little time to explain to you what the entrepreneur is. And see, what is the purpose of my lectures? I mean, how do my lectures differ than what you get in the textbook? I mean, why come to the lectures? Why not just sit at home and read the textbook? Remember I talked about this last time? How do my lectures differ than the textbook? The purpose of my lectures is to give you an overview. The purpose of the textbook is to give you the details. And the purpose of the supplemental materials is to give you the practice. And you need all three to do well in here. All right? See, what the purpose of my lectures is to help you step back 10 paces so you can look in and see the bigger picture. So you don't get lost in the details. See, if you just read the book, it's real easy to get lost in the details. I mean, you might read something for 3 or 4 pages and say to yourself, so what's the point of all this? And that's what I try to explain to you in my lectures. I try to show you how A is connected to B and B is connected to C. I mean, why are we doing what we're doing? See? Always try to get you to see the bigger picture. So that's what I'm going to do here in terms of the entrepreneur, because the entrepreneur is so vital to a free market system. You know, there's a book that's becoming talked about more and more that was very popular in the 1970s. Written by Ayn Rand, and the name of the book is called Atlas Shrugged. Now, in her book, Atlas, y'all know who Atlas was in Greek mythology? Atlas is the guy who held the world in his shoulders. Well, the reason she named her book Atlas Shrugged is that in her book, Atlas is the entrepreneur. And the world is the free market system. Now, if Atlas shrugs, see, he says, to heck with it. What happens to the world?
Falls.
It falls. See, in a free market system, if the entrepreneur says, hey, this isn't fun anymore, I'm going to take my marbles and go home, what happens to the system? It collapses. Now, is that the end of life on Earth? No, we're talking about an economic system here, right? But what's central to a free market system is the entrepreneur. Now, in order for a free market system to work, we got to let the winners win and the losers lose. Something that we're losing sight of, unfortunately. And I'm going to give you many examples of this, but that's one of the biggest threats to our system. See, a lot of this, I mean, if you think that the majority of these programs that our government is instituting by spending $900 billion is to help the economy, you've got a lot to learn, right? Very little of that will help the economy. Because most of that spending is not about making the economy grow or putting people back work. What's most of the spending about? In fact, this really gets to the heart of why we're in the problem we're in, and I can't get into the great details. I'm just trying to give you a very basic overall picture. But a big part of the problem is that we've got people in authority that want to mold the world in accordance to their own ideas. You know, they, for example, what is today? This is almost February 1st, right? February 10th, 10 days from now, 10 days from now, almost a great many of our businesses in America that sell toys are going to go out of business. Now, that includes stores, retail stores, that may sell even used toys. And a toy is a very broad definition there. A toy could be a bicycle. It could be a lot of things. In 10 days from now. Why is that? Because our politicians have decreed that the world would be better if there were no toys that were unsafe for children, especially toys that had lead in it. So in 10 days from now, if you own a retail store or a production company that makes toys, that if you have to have your product tested, professionally tested, for its safety in terms of lead. Now, these tests are very important. Like if a used store had toys to sell, it would cost them thousands of dollars to have those toys tested in order that they could legally sell them. Now, what's going to happen to our employment in the toy, in the, for anyone that's involved in the toy business? Yeah, I mean, how many kids would buy a bike and chew the tires, eat the tires, and yet bikes are come under this law. You think those politicians that passed this law had our economic growth and employment in mind? No, they got, what do they got in their mind? They got
children's safety.
We want children's safety. We're decreeing that all toys from here on, by the way, this law is not retroactive. It doesn't apply to new toys only, but it applies to toys that have been produced, over the past 200 years. See what I mean? I mean, any toys. It's not just new toys being produced. So, say what we've got here is we've got politicians who are saying, we think the world would be better if all toys were 100% safe. Well, by itself, that sounds good, but see, the point I'm making is that, is there priority economic growth and job creation? No, far from it. And most of this is a $900 billion bailout is of that nature. It's got nothing to do with economic growth or job creation. There's so many programs. This politician thinks that we ought to do this, and that politician thinks we ought to do that, and it's just a conglomeration of all these ideas that different politicians have that they've had for years, but they've never been able to pass because of the situation. But now everyone's in a panic, and this is a golden opportunity to bring a lot of these programs to the front. See, if yeah, that's what I say. I didn't say all of it. Now, some of it's good. I didn't say all. I'm not talking in extremes. I'm not saying that all the $900 billion is not going to be productive. The tax cuts would be certainly, but even there, if we want to generate growth, the first thing we ought to do is eliminate the capital gains tax. Now, what is a capital gains tax? By the way, we're one of the only countries in the world, certainly the only advanced country that has a capital gains tax, period. I mean, other countries have realized that that's so damaging to our growth. What's a capital gains tax? If you buy something at one price and sell it at a higher price, then the difference is a gain to you, and that gain is taxed. And sometimes that gain isn't even a realized gain, but only a paper gain. Yeah. Now, the point is that the capital gains tax is a downer when it comes to investments. I mean, investors hesitate when they say to themselves, well, if I make this investment, even if I gain, a good part of that gain, it will be taken away in taxes. So that lessens my incentive to make the investment in the first place. So if we were really interested in stimulating jobs and bringing about more economic growth, we could eliminate the capital gains tax. Now, has there been any discussion of this? Not even a discussion. It hasn't even been on the table. Now, the reason I got into all this is that, see, what we're talking about here in this course is the free market system. And in a free market system, in order for that system to function, you've got to let the winners win and the losers lose. I mean, what's the whole point of bailing out our banks? Y'all know what the term moral hazard means? Moral hazard. It's a very it's a powerful term, but what it means is, let's say you were a banker, and you said to yourself, you know, if I take these big risks and really go out on a limb, I can make a whole lot of money. Now, if I do that and I fall on my face, well, that's okay too, because the government will bail me out, and I'll make out regardless of what happens. Now, that's called moral hazard. And a free market system cannot function when moral hazard exists to a great extent. Okay, why is that? Because it encourages riskiness, you know, risky investments. I mean, that's a big reason why we're in the problem we're in today, because we've had too many risky investments. And unfortunately, you know, the higher the risk, the greater the fall. And we're in for a great fall. Well, a lot of those risky investments were brought about because of moral hazard. Because a lot of our business people said, hey, it's a win-win situation. As long as the government bails us out, we can't lose. And then what happens is the government gets into a place where, instead of the market determining who wins and who loses, the government decides who wins and who loses. Like in the game today, who wins? General Motors or Ford Motors?
Ford.
No, General Motors. Why? Because Ford Motors said, we don't need the bailout money. General Motors says, we'll take the bailout money. So what does General Motors do with a lot of the money? They sell cars at a great discount. Now, why can't Ford compete with General Motors at this time? Because they didn't accept the bailout money. So in other words, the government says, we are decreeing that Ford will benefit, that they will be the winners. No, I'm sorry. The General Motors will be the winners, and Ford Motor Company will be a loser. Say the government decides who wins and who loses.
So now, General Motors has to answer to the government, and they have all these provisions that General Motors has to deal with.
Yeah, that's true. That tends to be true, but even that's not uniform. In other words, what he's saying is that companies that accept government bailouts is not just free money, right? I mean, there are strings attached, and what those strings are depends on, you know, I mean, there's no uniform strings. I can give you lots of examples where companies that accept, I mean, government bailouts are in worse position than they were before. But even then, that's still an example of government deciding, you know, economic events and economic outcome. See, what I'm really trying to get at here is, what are we doing in this course? What we're doing in this course, we're trying to understand how a free market system works. That's what this economics course is all about.
Wouldn't the Ford company gain more in the end when General Motors would have to pay money or have those strings attached in, you know, a year or two from now?
Well, it depends what those strings are, and it depends what happens. I mean, I can't answer that. I mean, maybe yes and maybe no. But at this point, at this point, at, you know, right today, and I don't know what's going to happen in the future because I don't know what all the details are. And but what I am saying, all I'm saying here is that we're getting farther and farther away from a free market system. That's really what I'm saying. Okay. Now again, is that the end of the world? No, it's just, but it could be the end of our, you know, the free market as we know it. But you know what's happening. But that's what we're studying here. See, this is a complex issue, but you know what we're studying here is, you know, how does the system work? Now let me talk to you about the entrepreneur. Y'all know what leverage means?
Yes.
You know, in fact, economically, we are right now in a period that we call deleveraging. Now, what leveraging is taking something small and making something, having that something work for you in a big way. You know, for example, one way that investors use leveraging is that they bought, we can buy stock on the margin. You know, does anyone know what that means, to buy stock on the margin? Huh? No. Buying stock on the margin means, let's say that I'm a stockbroker, and you want to buy stock through me, and you want to buy, let's say, $1,000 worth of stock. And I say to you, I'll sell you $1,000 worth of stock, but you don't have to give me all $1,000 right now. You can give me, $600, and we'll write a futures contract stipulating when you're going to owe me the rest of $1,000. Now that's what's called buying stock on the margin. You know, you buy $1,000 worth of stock, but you don't pay $1,000 for it. You pay something less than $1,000. Now, do you have full control of that $1,000 worth of stock? Yes, and that's the point. All right, now you can go into the markets, and you can use this $1,000 worth of stock however you want. Now, is this $1,000 worth of stock going to have more clout than $600 worth of stock would? Yeah. Now, see, notice, what did you pay for the stock? $600. But you were leveraging yourself because instead of using $600 in engaging in the market, you are using $1,000. Now, what's the thinking here? Well, thinking is, you think of yourself as pretty shrewd and you really know markets, and the market itself is doing good as it was, you know, a year ago. And so you're going to use $1,000. You're going to make lots of money on it. And before the futures contract comes due, you're going to pay me back what you owe me, the $400. And you're going to make a big return. And how'd you make that big return? Because you leveraged yourself. That's called leveraging. And I'm going to explain to you here how you can do it and how entrepreneurs do it, but that's really the key to wealth building. The key to wealth building is leverage. A term I used last semester was a duplication. You've got to be able to duplicate yourself. Now, leveraging is good and can lead to big money going up, but what happens when things start to head south?
Bankrupt.
Yeah. Well, anyone know what a margin call is? A margin call is, as part of our futures contract, I held the right to demand payment from you at any time I want to. Now, when do I want to? I want to when the market value of those stocks is less than it was before. In other words, if the market value of your stocks don't I mean, if I believe that it's going down and down and that you may not be able to pay me, I'm not going to wait for this contract to expire. I'm going to come to you and say, I demand payment right now. Now, if I demand payment from you right now, what are you going to have to do to pay me? Sell your stocks and anything else, right? Sell your assets if you have to. Sell your house, you know. Sell your dog. Sell your, you know, your car. Sell. I mean, you know, you're going to have to sell whatever you've got to make good. And so that's what's called deleveraging. And when we're in a period of deleveraging, the more the multiplication upward, the more the multiplication downward. And right now, we are seeing a severe multiplication downward. See, everything is being exaggerated downward because of deleveraging. Now, let me explain to you how this works in a personal sense. Has anyone figured out how you can have more time and more money and more security in the future? Now, what is the lowest form of making money? I mean, it doesn't get any lower than this. A job. Any job. Because what is your limitation in terms of making money if you have a job? How many hours are there in a day? See, when you have a job, you are trading hours for dollars. Right? You work so many hours, you get back so many dollars. Now, the problem with that way of making money is what? There are only 24 hours in a day. Right? Now, let's say that I own a business. And let's say that I have 350 employees. That's about how many students I've got. Okay, I've got 350 employees. Now, let's say they work 8 hours a day. You all work 8 hours a day, let's say, for me. I can do that, right? I'm the teacher, you're a student. I own a business, you work for me, right? 7 hours. Now, you're going to... This is a business. This is not a student situation. I'm assuming this is a business, you know, a production business. Now, you're going to produce something in that 8-hour day that has a market value, right? And I'm going to sell that something in the market, and I'm going to make money, correct? Otherwise, why would I hire you, correct? Now, the income that you can generate in the first 7 hours goes to you. In what form? Well, wages, retirement benefits, insurance, taxes, things like that, right? So, you know, whatever you can produce in 7 hours, and then that thing is sold in the market and income comes in, you know, that goes to you. But what you can, the income that you can generate in the 8th hour goes to me. Now, if it didn't go to me, why would I hire you? I mean, why have I hired you? I've hired you why? To make money, right? So a part of what you, you know, can generate, the income that you can generate, has got to come to me. Otherwise, I'd be crazy to hire you. Correct? Now, here's the point. How many workers do I have? 350. How many working hours in a day is there for me? 350. Not 24. 350. It's just like I physically work 350 hours in a day. That's how much I'm getting paid. See, so I don't have the limitation on me that a wage earner has when they're simply trading hours for dollars. See, what I've done is I've been able to duplicate myself through you. Duplication. It's very much very similar to the concept of leverage. You know, it's the same. It's really the same concept, but slightly different. Now, notice this. I want to go to Florida. I'm tired of these cold, rainy days, and I just want to go soak up some sun in Florida. So I go to Florida for a month. Now, are you all going to say, hey, Mr. Long's gone to Florida. He's not around anymore. Let's take it easy. In fact, let's just take a vacation. Is that what you're going to say? I mean, if you did that, what would happen? You'd lose your job, right? In fact, many of you probably don't even know I'm gone, right? In other words, I can be in Florida, laying on the beach, sipping, you know, whatever, margaritas, and, you know, reading on the good novel, and you all back here working, and what's happened to my income? Hey, I'm still making the same income as if I were working 350 hours every day. But I'm not working. I'm on the beach soaking up the rays. You see what I mean? Oh, and here's something else. Let's say you've got a job, and that job you think pays you pretty good. I mean, let's say you've got a high-paying job, but something happens to you, and you can no longer perform the function of that job. Because, see, your security was in your ability to perform. And if you can't perform, then guess what? You don't have the job. If you don't have the job, you don't have the money. You don't have the income that the job gave you. So, see, you've got, having a job, you have very little security. Y'all see that? You have very little security when there's a job. Because your security is based on the ability to perform. If you can't perform, you don't have any security. Now, notice here if you own a business. If you own a business, then if you were to die even, then your family would simply inherit the business and, you know, income would keep on going. In fact, now here is a very... Now, I haven't seen this written any place, but this is a really... an insight. If you have a job, where's your security? Your security is to be as important as possible, correct? I mean, the harder it is to replace you, then the more secure your job, correct? Everybody with me on this? If you own a business, and now we're talking about security, we're talking about freedom here, we're talking about doing what you want to do, when you want to do it, and whom you want to do it with. We're talking about the advantages of duplication. If you own a business, what is your intent? I mean, where is freedom? You want to be as least important as possible. You want to be insignificant because that's where freedom is. The less important you are, the more freedom you have. You see, a good business owner wants to hire good people, reliable people, hardworking people, talented people, because their purpose is that business is going to run just as good without them as with them. See, if you can own a business and you can work it to where you're totally unimportant, you have found freedom. Now you can do whatever you want to do, and that business is going to continue making as much money as ever. See, just owning the business isn't really... There's owning the business and there's owning the business. I mean, if you own a business, but you've got some pride and you've got a big ego... And you're a kind of hands-on person. You're a micromanager, and you work it so that business you really can only run, you know, while you're there and making the decisions and doing all the work. Why own a business? I mean, that's crazy. Right? I mean, you might as well have a job. I mean, you'll make more money than if you had a job, maybe. I mean, there are other advantages, maybe. But there's no freedom in that. Right? So, now, if wealth building, and I'm still talking about the entrepreneur, you see, what makes the difference between a wage earner and an entrepreneur? The difference is between the 2 years. The difference is how you think. That's the difference. See, it's not something that you do. That's the difference between a wage earner and an entrepreneur. The difference is how you think. In fact, your situation may not change a bit, but if through taking this course, your way of thinking changes, then in your heart, you can become an entrepreneur. Because that's what we're talking about. An entrepreneur is a thought process. It's a way of thinking. Now, how can you duplicate yourself to do what I just said? One of the worst ways of duplicating yourself is to have employees. All right? Now, you can duplicate yourself through employees, but that's not the best way to do it. I mean, what are some problems with having employees? Well, no, that's not a problem because you're always going to pay them less than the income they're generating. Otherwise, you wouldn't hire them. But what are some other problems? Liability is a big one. You know, I once had an elderly care business where we hired caregivers to go in other people's homes. I had 92 caregivers my last year in business, and you know what my biggest expense was? More than wages and more than taxes, or not wages maybe, but more than taxes anyway. Workman's comp insurance was my biggest single expense. Now, wage is not an expense because you're getting something in return, but an expense is just, you know, money out the window. And workman's comp insurance was my biggest expense. In other words, there's lots of hassles when you got employees. And there's lots of regulations on you by government. And life. I mean, I felt when I had this business that I was public enemy number one in the eyes of the government. I mean, I could do no right and my employees could do no wrong. Now, let's suppose that you owned 100 apartments or houses that you rented out, or 100 rental units. And just to make fun, let's suppose that you're debt-free and everything's paid for. Now, are you duplicating yourself? Yeah. I mean, how are those people going to pay you rent? They're going to work, right? They're going to work, they're going to earn income, and they're going to give you part of their income. So what are you essentially doing? You are duplicating yourself through those other people, correct? Right? But notice the advantages here. Do you have to pay workman's comp insurance? I mean, do you have to abide by many of these other regulations that you would have if these were employees? I mean, there's a lot less headache here. I mean, there's headaches involved, you know, rental property, you know, the toilet, freezes, and they call you at 2 o'clock in the morning, and you know what I mean. I mean, you know, there are problems involved, but it's still better than having employees. Or how about this? How about this? Let's suppose that you had $50,000, $100,000. And you put the money in the markets or even in a savings account. Let's just keep it simple and you put it in a savings account. Let's say the bank pays you, 4 or 5% interest. Now, how does the bank pay you interest? I mean, how can they afford to pay you interest? They lend the money out. And when they lend the money out, how do people pay the bank the interest, the money back? They work, right? They take a part of what they earn, they give it to the bank. And the bank, in turn, gives a part of that to you. Correct? Now, what happens if these people become unemployed and they can't pay the bank? Does the bank come to you and say, I know you had, you know, this $100,000 in the savings account, but, you know, these people aren't paying us, so we can't pay you? Yeah, they're going to, yeah, exactly. See, you're going to get your money, you know, regardless. See? Now, do you have to pay workman's comp insurance on these people? Do you know who these people are? I mean, can you name them? I mean, do you have any responsibilities for these people that are working and giving part of their paycheck to you? No. I mean, this is worry-free. This is worry-free money. And yet you're duplicating yourself. Right? I mean, if you had enough money, you could be, you know, there's lots of people that make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year just, you know, the return on their money. Why? Because their money's working for them instead of them working for the money. I mean, which would you rather do? Work for money or have money work for you? I mean, which is the better deal?
Have money work for you.
Yeah, have money work for you, right? And that's what entrepreneurs do. See, there are hundreds of ways that you can duplicate yourself. See, what I'm saying is the lowest form of money is trading hours for dollars, as you do with a job. And there are hundreds of ways that you can duplicate yourself where you can leverage whatever you have. And by leveraging whatever you have, you can greatly not only increase your money, but you can increase your flexible time. You do what you want to do when you want to do it and whom you want to do it with, and your security. Now, what was that?
I was just going to say, the only thing is you have to spend money.
Well, that's what leveraging really is.
Yeah.
That's correct. You know, leveraging is taking something small and then using it, you know, leveraging it to bring about something big. But you got to have something small to begin with. And that's why, see, if you take my... I teach a personal finance... Now, what time is this class over? Isn't it... What time? Oh, okay. Well, I got a couple minutes, right? Okay, let me... I got a couple minutes here. Don't get Yancy yet. So I'll wrap this up by... let's see. What point was I going to make now? Huh?
Talking about your personal finance.
Oh, yeah. I teach a personal finance class, which has always been popular, but, I mean, so far this semester I got 35 students. That's pretty good for, you know, for an elective course. But anyway, it's a great course. It teaches you how to, it's FIN 107, and it teaches how to make money work for you and you work for the money. And, you know, there's a chapter on, well, the first chapter is on saving. See, the source of all wealth building begins on the your wealth building begins on the day that you decide to pay yourself first. Everyone who's ever become wealthy has made that decision at some point. Now, what does it mean to pay yourself first? That means that you earn a certain amount of money. And you've got all these obligations, right? You've got car payments, you've got rent, and you've got this, and you've got that, and right? Well, paying yourself first means I'm going to take a certain percent of what I make, and I'm going to pay myself. I'm going to put it in the savings. And then I'm going to do everything else. Okay? See, what you were talking about, remember what you were talking about? You got to have something to start with. Well, that's the something that everyone can do. See, wealth building is a decision. No matter what your position in life, no matter how little you've got, no matter what disadvantage you've got, you can be wealthy, and that wealth is only a decision away. Period. And not only can you have wealth, but you can have more time and more money and more security than anybody that has a job. Well, that's something to think about, right? Okay, it's 1:45, so I shall see you all next time.